generations of Isaac the patriarch, but we are continuing to focus on where the scripture has led us, and that is the life of Jacob. And here we are looking at Jacob who will meet Rachel. And we have most recently seen that Jacob has been exiled from his home after deceiving his father and under the threat of his brother Esau, who is threatened to murder him. So Jacob is on the run for his life, and at the instruction of his mother, Rebekah, he is traveling to Paddan Aram, also known as Haran, to find his future wife. So Isaac has blessed Jacob a second time before he has departed, but Jacob is sent away empty-handed and alone, and he will make this exceedingly long journey to the region of Haran to find this bride to be. So on the first night of travel, he sleeps, and as he's sleeping, he has this theophany, an appearance of God, appearing to him in a dream, and he sees a ladder extending from earth into heaven. And on this ladder are angels ascending and descending, and he sees God atop that ladder. And this vision depicts the work of God, where he is constantly mediating in the lives of sinful people like Jacob, like me, and like you. And Jacob is shown this vision as a way of teaching him that he can expect that God will be with him and will watch over him and will fulfill the promises that he is about to make to him. Jacob's ladder is best understood as a type. And when we talk about a type, it is something that is shown to us in the Old Testament that is later fulfilled in the New Testament. And so this type represents Christ's mediatorial position connecting heaven and earth. This work of mediation may be aided by angels, as we see in Jacob's ladder, but the ladder was and is the focus. Jesus is the focus of that divine ladder, as we referenced in John chapter 1, verses 50 and 51, when Jesus taught Nathanael. So for the sake of time, I won't go into more detail about Jacob's ladder. If you weren't here last week and would like to hear more about what I taught on Jacob's ladder, I would refer you back to last week's message, where there is a lot more detail provided there. But as Jacob sees this vision, he hears with his own ears from God himself the covenant promise of land, of descendants, and of these descendants being a blessing to all the families of the world, just as Abraham heard from God, as Isaac heard from God, which means that Jacob is included as a patriarch, and he would one day be the father of the nation of Israel, which is indicated later on in Genesis when his name is changed from Jacob to Israel. So this theophany, this appearance by God in the dream, leads Jacob to worship God. This is the first time anywhere we are told of Jacob worshiping God. And Jacob is now energized for this long journey to find his bride. And this brings us to chapter 29, which contains two very long sections. There's two sections here. The first one covers verses 1 through 14, and it details Jacob's experience in three scenes that take place over one afternoon. The second section covers verses 15 through 30, and it details Jacob's marriages to Leah and Rachel, and it will cover a period of 14 years. Now, it's not possible to get through these two sections in a meaningful way. I tried, and it's just not possible to do that. So we're going to look at section 1 today, and we're going to look at section 2 next time. So after this amazing experience with God at Bethel, where Jacob meets God and sees the ladder extending from earth into heaven, and he hears God speak the covenant promise, and that God promises to be with him and to keep him, meaning he would provide and protect, we read this in verses 1 through 14. Then Jacob went on his journey and came to the land of the sons of the east. He looked and saw a well in the field, and behold, three flocks of sheep were lying there beside it, for from that well they watered the flocks. Now the stone on the mouth of the well was large. When all the flocks were gathered there, they would then roll the stone from the mouth of the well and water the sheep and put the stone back in its place on the mouth of the well. Jacob said to them, "My brothers, where are you from?" And they said, "We are from Haran." And he said to them, "Do you know Laban, the son of Nahor?" And they said, "We know him." And he said to them, "Is it well with him?" And they said, "It is well, and here is Rachel, his daughter, coming with the sheep." He said, "Behold, it is still high day. Is it not time for the livestock to be gathered, water the sheep, and go pasture them?" But they said, "We cannot until all the flocks are gathered, and they roll the stone from the mouth of the well, then we water the sheep." While he was still speaking with them, Rachel came with her father's sheep, for she was a shepherdess. When Jacob saw Rachel, the daughter of Laban, his mother's brother, and the sheep of Laban, his mother's brother, Jacob went up and rolled the stone from the mouth of the well and watered the flock of Laban, his mother's brother. Then Jacob kissed Rachel and lifted his voice and wept. Jacob told Rachel that he was a relative of her father and that he was Rebekah's son, and she ran and told her father. So when Laban heard the news of Jacob, his sister's son, and ran to meet him, he embraced him and kissed him and brought him to his house. Then he related to Laban all these things. Laban said to him, "Surely you are my bone and my flesh," and he stayed with him a month. Now, when you read through this narrative, it's very easy to say, well, that's pretty interesting, let's move on. But there's so much more in here than we can really understand, and this is, again, why it's necessary to have scholarship that pulls out the importance of what is here, because there's a lot that our author, Moses, wants us to understand that is not as obvious to us because we don't have a Jewish mindset and a Jewish understanding, so we miss a lot of this stuff, and that's why you can't just run through to the end of verse 30 and get through this in a meaningful way. So we're going to look at this in one section. Letter H in the ongoing outline is Jacob meets Rachel. In the first part of this, the first scene, if you will, is Jacob at the well. Verse 1 is really an introduction, and it says, Jacob went on his journey and came to the land of the sons of the east. Now, as a footnote, the reference here, the sons of the east, if you remember, in our earlier study of Genesis, anytime there is a reference to the east, it means something negative. For example, when Adam was banished, he went to the east. Anytime something bad happened, they went to the east. And so the sons of the east, the clan of Laban, is not the favored clan of Abraham's ancestors. And so there is this idea that something not good is going to happen because Jacob is going to go to the sons of the east. But again, because we don't have the Jewish mindset and understanding, this is something that we miss. But again, Jacob is going to the sons of the east. We aren't told anything about this nearly 1,000-mile journey that Jacob takes to get to Haran from Bethel. We're not told how long it takes, who he meets, how he survives, nothing. All we're told is that he has now arrived in the land of the sons of the east. What is important to the author, Moses, is he wants for us to compare and contrast Jacob's experience with finding a bride against that of Isaac's finding of a bride through Abraham's sending of Eliezer, his faithful, trusted servant, many years before. This is what our author wants us to focus on. And so there are five significant points that we're going to pull out of this that make this section of this narrative very, very important to us. Number one, the first point here is a caravan that Eleazar took versus Jacob being absolutely alone. So when Abraham sent his trusted servant Eleazar to go and find a bride for Isaac, he sent him with a large delegation, many, many camels, lots of people, and lots of gifts. Eleazar didn't go alone. Jacob, on the other hand, is by himself. He is so alone that when he sets up camp on that very first night, he uses a rock that he finds as a pillow. You get the idea that he doesn't even have a backpack to roll up and stick under his head. He's got nothing except what he's wearing, and he's bringing nothing with him. He's traveling on foot using a pillow for a rock. It begs the question, why did Isaac, who knew what Abraham sent Eleazar off with for the purpose of finding a bride, why did Isaac send Jacob away with absolutely nothing? Now, Jacob sent Isaac away after blessing him a second time, so it would be assumed that Isaac knew that Jacob was going off to find a bride because he gave him the instruction, you are not to find a bride from amongst the Canaanites, right? So why did Isaac do that? Was it because he didn't really love his son Jacob like he loved his son Esau? Was he bearing a grudge against Jacob because he had deceived him three times and lied and said, I am your son Esau? We aren't told why. We can only guess. But it does beg the question, why would Isaac do this? And why is Jacob traveling absolutely alone? It is a vastly different experience from how Eleazar was sent to find a bride, and Isaac would have known this distinct difference. So Jacob has now arrived in the land of the sons of the east, and he comes upon a well out in the field, and he sees the first thing that Moses draws our attention to here is letter A, a stone that blocks the well. What's the big deal about the stone that blocks the well? Verses 2 and 3. He looked, Jacob, and saw a well in the field, and behold, three flocks of sheep were lying there beside it, for from that well they watered the flocks. Now the stone on the mouth of the well was large. When all the flocks were gathered there, they would then roll the stone from the mouth of the well and water the sheep and put the stone back in its place on the mouth of the well. So that large stone would cover the mouth of the well to keep predators away, and it would keep shepherds who were not a part of the agreed upon group of shepherds who would water their flocks from that well. It would keep the individual shepherds out of that well. It was so large that an individual shepherd would not be able to water his flock from that well. That was the purpose of this large stone covering that well. So Jacob sees the well, he sees the flock, and he sees the large stone. This large well is out in the field. It's away from the city. It's an outlying well in the fields that shepherds would use to water their flocks out in the field. He sees the flock of sheep that are in need of watering, as well as the large rock covering the well, and it requires several shepherds to remove the rock in order to water the flocks. That's an important point. Moses highlights the problem, the large stone. The three flocks indicate that there would be three shepherds, but they are uninterested in moving the rock for unknown reasons. We're only left to speculate, but Jacob will fill in the reason why he thinks they haven't moved the rock. But we are left to assume that it's perhaps too big for them to move. Now, similarly, Eleazar also arrived in Haran at a well and with his caravan of camels and with people. And so the well becomes a place of providential appointment for God to bring together the search for a bride. But what takes place at the well is going to be remarkably different. And again, this is what our author Moses wants to highlight. So letter B, Jacob encounters the shepherds. He begins a dialogue with them, verses 4-6. Jacob says to them, "My brothers, where are you from?" And they said, "We are from Haran." He said to them, "Do you know Laban, the son of Nahor?" They said, "We know him." And he said to them, "Is it well with him?" And they said, "It is well. And here is Rachel, his daughter, coming with the sheep." Now, what we notice in this exchange is that Jacob has no idea where he is. He's been traveling for we don't know how long. It's a nearly 1,000-mile journey. I would imagine it would have taken months for him to make this journey. But he's in the right place in Haran, and we are also going to discover that he's in the right place now at the right time, because lo and behold, Rachel's about to make her entrance. But they also know who Laban is, the uncle that he is hoping to find, and they confirm that Laban is doing well. He's not dead, he's not missing, and they inform Jacob that his daughter Rachel, who is a shepherdess, is approaching with Laban's flock. So the providence of God is being seen in the fact that Rachel is right around the corner, just as he is inquiring about the well-being of Uncle Laban. Jacob continues the dialogue in verses 7-8, and he says, "Behold, it is still high day. Is it not time for the livestock to be gathered? Water the sheep and go pasture them." Now, in the Hebrew, there are three verbs here. There's three action words: behold, water, go. And this is almost an imperative that Jacob is speaking to the shepherds. Behold, water, go. Now, the rock is important. It is a barrier to the watering of the flock, to them being able to get back out into the pasture, and commentators draw attention to the rock Jacob used as a pillow, and the rock here that is a barrier to the sheep being able to get watered. So the rock that Jacob used as a pillow and set up as a pillar is somehow connected to the rock that is a barrier to the sheep being watered. Commentators are drawing upon this connection as a way that Moses is using a literary style that would be known to the Jewish mind to draw something important out to his readers. The connection here is found in God's promise to be with Jacob and what happens when Jacob by himself moves this large stone that is covering the watering hole and preventing the sheep from being watered. Now, it continues here in verses 9 and 10. While he was still speaking with the shepherds, Rachel came with her father's sheep, for she was a shepherdess. When Jacob saw Rachel, the daughter of Laban, his mother's brother, and the sheep of Laban, his mother's brother, and the sheep of Laban, his mother's brother, Jacob went up and rolled the stone from the mouth of the well and watered the flock of Laban, his mother's brother. So in Jacob's estimation, the three shepherds sitting around doing nothing should have been able to move the stone to water the flocks and get them back to pasture. So Jacob thinks they're being lazy, perhaps waiting for several other shepherds to arrive in order to lighten the load of moving the rock, but this provided the opportunity for Jacob to meet Rachel, to impress her by moving the large stone, and also creating an opportunity for Jacob to meet Rachel. So seeing the laziness of the shepherds and the need for Rachel to water the flocks, Jacob takes it upon himself to move the large stone. Now, commentators note that this would have taken extraordinary strength, and probably it was with the Lord's help that he was able to move the stone by himself, drawing attention to the stone and the Lord being with Jacob. So there is this drawing attention to the large stone at the very beginning of seeing the well, of the stone not being moved by the shepherds that are gathered there, the need to move the stone by Jacob and his ability to move that by himself, and the promise of the Lord being with him. And now he has impressed impressed Rachel by moving the stone, and it is confirmed to Jacob that the Lord is with him because he has moved this stone all by himself. Now, there's also something here in verse 10 that is not as important to us as it should be. There is this repetition that our author uses to make a very important point. Three times we see the wording here of Laban, his mother's brother. Do you see that? Rachel, the daughter of Laban, his mother's brother, and the sheep of Laban, his mother's brother, and watered the flock of Laban, his mother's brother. Now, why did Moses word it that way? Commentators tell us this means that Jacob is as interested in earning the favor of Laban as he is in meeting Rachel. Because what is Rachel going to do when she runs back and tells her father about this encounter? This guy moved the stone all by himself. That's going to mean a lot to Laban, his mother's brother. So Moses is drawing this point out. He's making a very specific point here. So at this point, there are three more instances of comparison and contrast with Eleazar's encounter at the well with searching for Isaac's bride. So point two in this comparison and contrast is prayer versus prayerlessness. So going back to Eleazar's encounter at the well, before he approached the well, he saw it, he stopped, and he prayed, and he set the criteria by which he would know that the Lord's hand was at work before he, Eleazar, did anything. Let's go back and look at what happened in Genesis 24, verses 12 through 14. This is Eleazar. And he said, "O Lord, the God of my master Abraham, please grant me success today and show loving kindness to my master Abraham. Behold, I am standing by the spring, and the daughters of the men of the city are coming out to draw water. Now may it be that the girl to whom I say, 'Please let down your jar so that I may drink,' and who answers, 'Drink, and I will water your camels also,' may she be the one whom you have appointed for your servant Isaac, and by this I will know that you have shown loving kindness to my master." So there's a gathering. There's many people coming and going from the well. And so Eleazar is going to go up and speak to a girl. And the one who answers him in this way, he will know that is the one that God has selected. And that is exactly what Rebekah does. And Eleazar knows that this is the one that God has selected. Jacob does not pray. Jacob did not seek the Lord's guidance at all. He relied upon himself alone. He didn't say a thing. God did not enter into Jacob's mind at all. He sees Rachel. He knows this is Laban's daughter. He likes what he sees. And Jacob just plows straight ahead. Right? Prayer versus prayerlessness. Point three, worship versus worshiplessness. When Eleazar's criteria had been met, it was clear to him that God had led him to Rebekah, and as a result, Eleazar worshiped God. Again, going back to Genesis 24, Verse 26, then the man bowed low and worshiped the Lord. He said, blessed be the Lord, the God of my master Abraham, who has not forsaken his loving kindness and his truth toward my master. As for me, the Lord has guided me in the way to the house of my master's brothers. Eleazar knew God had led him to the right woman, and the first thing Eleazar did was he bowed low and he worshiped God. When Jacob had confirmation that Rachel was in fact Laban's daughter and that he liked what he saw, he simply assumed that this was the one that God had chosen for him. He made that assumption, but because he never prayed, because he never sought the Lord for guidance, he never worshiped God when he found what he thought was the provision of a wife. Now, we could assume it was the provision of a wife, but we don't really know that for sure, do we? We can read ahead and we can see what happened, and we can say, well, yeah, but we can say, but what if? Because Jacob never prayed, we don't know how this story would have unfolded otherwise, do we? Point four, in the differences, the contrast in Eleazar's experience and in Jacob's experience is this, service versus servitude. In Eleazar's encounter at the well, when Rebekah came out and he asked her for some water, she went ahead and watered all of the camels, and that would have taken multiple trips back and forth to the well to water all of the camels. Here, the reverse takes place. Jacob waters Rachel's sheep. And because the sheep actually belong to Laban, Jacob is watering Laban's sheep. It's a foreshadowing of the servitude that Jacob is going to render to Laban, his uncle, in the future. Laban is the owner of the sheep, and because Jacob approached the well without ever praying, without ever seeking the Lord's guidance, we're left to wonder how God might have guided Jacob differently in this environment, in this encounter, had he been a man of prayer as opposed to being a man of impulse. Clearly, Laban was impressed with Jacob, so much so, as we know in the story, he would squeeze a 14-year contract out of Jacob in exchange for the marriage to his daughter. So the second scene that we have here is Jacob officially meets Rachel. Verse 11. Then Jacob kissed Rachel and lifted his voice and wept. So he's removed the stone single-handedly. He's watered the sheep. And now he's kissed Rachel and lifted his voice and wept. Now, this was not a romantic kiss. It was a kiss of hospitality where one kisses someone on both cheeks. It's a very common, a very courteous, a very cordial greeting. After all, she is his cousin, and this is their very first meeting. But for Jacob, in his mind, it's confirmation that this is the right girl, that this is going to be his wife, and he lifts his voice in celebration, and he begins to weep like a love-struck little boy, pouring out his heart. But it never says that he lifts his voice to God, that he cries out to God, that he lifts his voice in prayer to God, nothing. He's just lifting his voice, I guess in tears, over happiness that he's finally met the woman that he assumes is supposed to be his wife. At this point, Jacob then introduces himself to Rachel. Verse 12, Jacob told Rachel that he was a relative of her father and that he was Rebekah's son And she ran and told her father. So the introduction should have preceded the kiss, but Jacob is impulsive and impatient and anxious to get on with the mission of marrying the girl of his dreams that he's just met some 30 seconds earlier. He's ready to get after it. So after learning of Jacob's identity, Rachel, like Rebecca, is filled with joy and runs back home to tell her father. And this takes us to the third scene. Jacob meets Laban. Verse 13. So when Laban heard the news of Jacob, his sister's son, he ran to meet him and embraced him and kissed him and brought him to his house. Then he related to Laban all these things. So after getting back to the house, Jacob tells Laban the long story of why he's traveled this long distance, that he is the heir to Isaac's fortune, to the covenant promise, to all that has transpired. And you have to know that Laban is very, very excited because he remembers when Abraham visited many years before, and he remembers the exceedingly generous dowry that Abraham paid through Eliezer for Rebekah, Laban's sister. And so now Jacob has arrived, and Eliezer has to have expected a very generous dowry again. And that brings us to point number 5 in the contrast, and that is a dowry versus being empty-handed. Eliezer had gifts, many gifts, gold, other fine articles to pay for Rebekah. And a very greedy Laban expected another generous dowry. But here comes Jacob, who has absolutely nothing. And you have to know that Laban is very, very disappointed. Jacob's got nothing but the clothes on his back. And if he could have mustered anything along the journey, it would have never compared to what Eliezer gave when he was buying the bride Rebecca. So there's no dowry. And this section closes with verse 14. Laban said to him, "Surely you are my bone and my flesh." And as a segue into the next section, it says, and he stayed with him a month. So up until this last part of verse 14, this entire interaction takes place in one afternoon. And as an introduction into this next section, Jacob stays with Laban for a month. And this month gives Laban the opportunity to come up with a plan where he's going to figure out a way to get a dowry that is going to be worth his while, and this is exactly what is going to take place. So Jacob is accepted as a part of the family. He's no longer homeless. He's found refuge in his uncle's house at the goodwill of the Lord. God has taken care of him. He's got him there. He's now found a place to stay. And as an end of this family reunion, Jacob is going to stay for a month, but the stay gets extended with the conversation about wages, which will be the beginning part of the next section. And that arrangement quickly turns into what could be considered an incarceration through the cunning, manipulative, deceitful efforts of good old Uncle Laban, which we're going to look at next time. Now, all of that begs the question, you have to wonder how this could have been different if Jacob would have begun this interaction with prayer. If Jacob would have stopped before he approached the well and said, "God, here I am, what should I do?" Do you think God would have been silent? Do you think God would have said, "Well, Jacob, you got to figure it out for yourself"? Do you think that's what God would have said? You know, a lot of times we assume that things happen in Scripture just the way they did because that's the way God wanted it to happen. But I want to tell you that I don't believe that's true at all. What would have happened if Isaac would have done the right thing when he sent Jacob away, if he would have given him a few servants, a few animals, and a dowry in exchange for his bride-to-be? Do you think that Jacob would have had to have worked for 14 years in exchange for his bride? We can only speculate. But just because Jacob lived for 14 years does not mean that that was the way God intended for it to happen. Now, God used those 14 years to teach Jacob very valuable lessons. But that's not the only way that God could have taught Jacob those same valuable lessons. So it seems that Jacob's sin of prayerlessness and Isaac's sin of not loving his son and providing for his son in the way that he should is going to cost Jacob very, very dearly. And in fact, it's going to cost Jacob a full 20 years of service to Uncle Laban, 14 years of which will be required before he can marry his beloved Rachel. So all of this leads us to the question, what price do we pay because we live our lives in a constant state of prayerlessness, never thinking about asking, God, what do you want? God, what should I do? God, what's the right thing here? And although God will work all things for the good of those who love him and are called according to his purposes, not all things work in our lives the way God intended for them to work. I believe we go through a lot more pain and suffering and difficulty because we live lives of prayerlessness, not seeking the guidance of the Lord. Or we live lives of sin, not doing what we know we ought to do. Well, let's bow our heads in prayer.